Christianity.
And Marxism continued, but that's a very generalized statement, and we need to focus the issue.
No, I don't think so. I don't think that's fruitful at all. I think what we can go at are some questions like, what should our Christian response be to the growth of Marxism that we see, or the growth of communism in other lands? Specifically, where we have sister churches, can we work alongside that kind of a system, that kind of a government, or can we not? What sort of statements do we have to make?
Well, I would suggest then that the panel members sort of outlined this in the beginning, so that'll sort of direct the thinking of the assembled people.
Who was here this morning? How about some of your reflections while we have a little time? Paul's on his way. He'll be here in a minute. And he's going to summarize this morning briefly. But issues that you would like to hear developed further, or...
Say so.
Sure.
Covered.
No, that's fine.
Okay, I was wondering, you gave the three orders, the history, the prehistory.
Yeah.
I was wondering what Marx's idea of history was, besides just the level.
Okay. Yeah, that may be, that ties in, though, with one of the questions that was clearly emerging today was, you know, that Marx's concept of history is over against Christians understanding the kingdom of God. I mean, that was really emerging at the end, clearly, and we were not of one mind that what the kingdom of God means is would be understandable or expected, but
those are
so weighty and so
One other way of stating the question might be, must Christianity be capitalist, or can Christianity also be Marxist?
Yeah, we've wrestled with that a little bit in the last couple of, seems to me, and Paul's been wrestling with that and continues.
Hadn't it been said that capitalism and communism, or Christianity and communism, is an awful lot alike except for the point of their worship?
Yeah, I was going to start out with just kind of affirming that, yeah. That's why we're in this tension, probably.
I guess back to the earlier topic, more spoken to the practical interaction between a group, as far as individual to individual, in terms of present daily life.
Mm-hmm. Paul wanted to pick up on that, too. I had just a brief conversation with him about this, and he wanted to talk about ways of maybe developing greater rapport and understanding, therefore.
We might also say, is Christianity under capitalism an extension of a Constantinian conversion, or does Christianity do best in a more hostile environment?
Yeah, it's moving off on another, but yeah. I think we've been hearing Paul say very clearly it's time to address that issue very intentionally.
The thing that I would look at is the open end, rather than the either or mentality that we seem to have, that we either have to be, if we're Christian, we have to be Catholic, or we cannot be Christian.
Okay.
Some of that gap.
Yeah.
At the open end.
See, what's difficult, the village changes so much from week to week, and over the last 3 weeks we have dealt...
That would have been perfect 2 weeks.
Yeah, 2 weeks ago we were really onto this. We had four nights in a row here that practically... they were wild. I mean, really, leaving people frustrated at the end, and the discussion was still over. And a forum, of course, is almost by design frustrating. I mean, there's just no way we arrive at resolution here. But hopefully we can open up the issue in ways that at least creates some greater depth of understanding or some new perspectives or ways of looking. But we'll be intentionally, or not intentionally, but inevitably frustrating, I think, especially on issues as heavy as the one we've been addressing today. We're waiting for Paul, so I'm just trying to get some sense of direction that is growing out of. My interest is that the discussions grow out of the agenda that we have, not that a couple of us decide for us. I mean, that's my function, is to try to gather the the key issues and then just let it happen here. So I want to make sure that I'm not just imposing my perspective or the perspective of a couple people on what we discuss. Here he comes.
I will ring the bell.
Oh, that's
okay. See, Paul, you're doing better. You're only 8 minutes late this time.
Punctuality is not one of we's virtue, or it's a we virtue for Paul, or
something. Oh, that was nice.
There's no one that I've given a harder time in the village in my near 3 weeks than Paul, but that's done out of great affection and respect for his ministry, and that's all I'm going to say on that, because I don't want to cry and exert itself. Grateful that you didn't have vespers tonight, Paul. Anyway, the lady did go over to ring the bell,
didn't
she?
No.
Yes.
She
would.
She did.
Well, welcome officially to the forum, and tonight will be a continuation in certain ways of what we were dealing with this morning when Paul Wee and Jan Hansen combined in the lecture to discuss the subject, the relationship of Christianity with the Marxist system of thought and the Marxist systems in the world. And we were talking just as we were gathering, and someone made the mention of the fact that maybe it's because Christianity and Marxist thought are so close in so many ways that we have such difficulty in discussing it. I think that's most often the case. Where our differences are clear, and where there are marked distinctions between us, we can live rather comfortably with that. But you start to narrow that and deal in subtleties, and where we are close, then the issues really heat up. I see that so often in the Christian community, as the internal arguments within the Christian community are much more intense and emotional than are those between Christianity and other world religions. We begin to hear some deference there and some understanding, but with one another we can just really get wild. I think that's the case surely with the subject under discussion tonight, Christianity and Marxism. I think we saw that this morning. We experienced some of that, and hopefully this evening we're going to continue that discussion and do so first of all by Paul's recapitulating briefly. Pause, underscoring. Anyway, Paul summarizing the discussion. Jan wisely left the village today, so he doesn't have to be here to defend anything this morning, so it's all on Paul's shoulders. But Paul, would you please kind of bring us up?
3 minutes.
3 minutes, Paul.
If I talk slowly, could it be 6 minutes?
And if you talk swiftly like you normally do, it'll be a minute and a half.
Well, it sort of reminds me of this time.
This didn't come. Okay.
It reminds me of time when, who was it? Walt Bowman stood up to tell a story. And he said, I'd like to tell a story about this dumb Norwegian. And Jay Spoonheim says, he's sitting next to me, says, hey, Walt, excuse me, but I'm Norwegian, And Walt says, oh, Reverend Spoonheim, excuse me, oh, then I'll tell it very slowly.
Yeah.
I can't do it at Vesper, though.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Well, just very briefly, we started out by saying that the church should be, of all the groupings within society, especially in our society, our Western society, the place where one can discuss anything and everything in even sort of normally hot issues, things that arouse great passion, that are connected with great emotion, that the church should be the arena where such things can be talked about in a healthy give and take and in a willingness to disagree and still accept one another in terms of the gospel of Christ. That was sort of basic bottom line of our beginning. We said by way of introduction this morning that since 1848, when the Communist Manifesto came out, this book, which is really the Bible of the Communist Movement by Marx and Engels, a great deal has happened. We are familiar with the Russian Revolution, of course, but something beyond that has happened, where the waves of, in various forms, a great variety of forms of Marxism have taken root within social, economic, and political structures, have been the predominant ideology of various nation states, and that now through Asia, Africa, Latin America, and not only Eastern Europe and portions of Western Europe, there are in various forms new waves of Marxism arising. What is the big allure of Marxism, in spite of the fact that some of the historical examples make one shudder? What is it about this ideology, this belief system, that captures the imagination of so many people in our world today, especially those who are poor, who are in some way oppressed or disenfranchised, the have-nots of the world? We said, secondly, that even in Christian circles, there's a great deal of attraction. Marx, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, when he sat in prison, sat next to a great many Marxists, of course, who died in the prison camps also, during the Second World War, and he saw a great deal of kinship with these people and believed that among them was a burning passion for the poor and the disenfranchised of society. Why is it that even the revolutionary priests of Latin America, there are quite a few, in the acts of charity, some often come up against a place where you realize that charity is not the answer, but that justice among the structures of society is the answer, and that you have to work at quite a different level in your task in terms of the gospel of Christ. And then you discover that you're right next to Marxists, and that they are also working to overthrow unjust political and economic systems. And we went on and gave a few other examples of Camilo Torres, the Berrigans, maybe the Makanu Yesu Church of Ethiopia, deeply pietistic church. But they saw, at least in the struggle to overthrow the feudalism of Haile Selassie, they found their allies in the Marxist camp. Strange bedfellows, of course. They learned a very hard lesson by what followed when the Marxists took over. Or we could talk about Namibia today, where some members of the church would, just because of the oppression against them is so great, would not be averse to seeing the Russians and the Cubans come into their country if it meant at least an initial deliverance from them. Well, we went from this introduction to talking about basic Marxist theory. And so we stayed with Orthodox Marxism for maybe half an hour. And we said that there were three stages of Marxism or communism. The first stage was original or primitive communism, a sort of a Garden of Eden state of perfection. The second stage was prehistory, the stage that we're living in now. And prehistory included the formation of tribes, the formation of towns, the development of feudal economy, feudal society, and we said that according to Marx, history moved inexorably, according to the laws of determinism, you couldn't do anything about it, from feudalism to capitalism to socialism to communism or the classless society. And freedom constitutes being aware of what's going to happen anyway. And if you're if you rise up to oppose it, you'll just be rolled over, because it has its own law and it's governed by its own economic force. We said, secondly, that in this stage, it was the economic factor that determined everything. If you had a capitalist base, then politics would be capitalistic, the religion would be capitalistic, the art would be capitalistic, education would be capitalistic, and that the economic factor determined the nature of man, and not the other way around. And so nothing was stable in the world except the economic factor, which was deterministic. We said that when Marx meant that religion was the opiate of the people, he said that he meant that under a capitalistic system, the creation of religion stems from the economic factor, and that the religion will be capitalistic. And in this case, the religion will be there to safeguard the well-being of the upper classes, which he called the bourgeoisie. Religion is only there to safeguard the rights of the bourgeoisie, the privileges of the bourgeoisie, and to tranquilize the masses from the hard realities experienced in the alienation from the Industrial Revolution, the hard working conditions of life. And this is the way he interpreted also the black experience in slavery in the United States. He said, I don't know if he said, but you know, when I get to heaven, I'm going to put on my shoes. You know, you sing the great Negro spirituals. You don't want your shoes now. You're going to get your shoes when you get to heaven. And all of a sort of otherworldly, building another world upon this world, where you were going to have fulfillment. But in this world, just forget it. Marx says a capitalistic religion is the opium of the people, tranquilizing the masses, dulling their edge, the revolutionary edge that might bring about a basic change. And he says as soon as capitalism is done away, then religion will just disintegrate on its own, which is still the policy in Eastern Europe, although they have to help it a little bit. Now, finally, we said that the parallels, we said that Marxism was really a Christian heresy. We called it a pseudo-religion. Marxism is based, it has its own Bible, the Communist Manifesto. It understood, it has its own prophets. It has its own turning point in history. A cataclysmic event in history, that is the emergence of the proletariat, is like the coming of Jesus Christ. This is a turning point in history, and that history moves in a straight line. There are not many interpretations of history that see history moving along a horizontal line in some direction. But both Judeo-Christianity and Marxism do that. It's a contradiction, say, of the Hindu understanding, or Buddhist or Greek understanding, or Taoism, or most of the religions of the world that work in a circle or in a cycle. These are historical interpretations of history, that time is the basic category. Both Christianity and Marxism say that man is estranged from himself, from his essential nature, and from also objects in the world. Especially for Marx, this was in terms of the factory worker creating a product over which he had no control. You create an object, but it's the owner of the factory that determines how that product would be used. This is the alienation of man from his labor, or her labor. In both, the followers are able to sort of glimpse the future. In the case of Christianity, the kingdom of God. In the case of Marxism, the classless society. In both of them, the apprehension of truth is linked to the doing of truth. Marx says in his 11th thesis against Feuerbach, up until now, historians or philosophers have only interpreted the world. The point is to change it. And the whole idea of apprehending the truth of history is to participate in the movement of history. And so we say in the Christian faith that it takes basic commitment to God's action in history, and not any memorization of doctrines and so forth, that allows a person to be grasped by the power of the new life in Christ. Now, we said that both Christianity and Marxism had a strong moral passion within them. Both had the stress on communal values. In Christianity, it is the new community. It's the new reality. And even the church is not an individualistic thing, but it is many slices in one loaf, many bricks, one building, many branches, one vine, many members, but one body. The images were all community images. Now finally, we said, and this was the one we spent the most time on, that just as Marx rejected a type of religion, which he called ideology, a religion of privilege, of 19th century Prussian aristocracy, a religion which only gave the crumbs that fell from the table of the rich to the poor, and did nothing for justice. We said that this was a religion in which, that the religion that Marx rejected is the religion that Christianity also rejects. In other words, the Marxist critique of religion, we would probably agree with, in order that we might accentuate what we believe the legitimate dynamic and reality of Jesus Christ. In other words, at least we're playing with the notion of accepting, basically, Marx's rejection of what he called religion. We said that idea, we are not interested in either. At least this is the position that I would take personally. Now we said that there are differences between Marxism and Christianity. First of all, we looked at the classless society as itself an ideology in Marx's sense. We said that the Christian view of the kingdom of God does not assume that humans are going to overcome the ambiguities of history within the historical process. Christians believe that we, no matter how hard we try, we are not going to build a utopia on this earth. We said that contrary to Marx's view, that there would be a perfection attained, that Christianity assumes that within every creation of people and within the basic reality of the world and people, the substance of evil was so strong that there was evil, and if you didn't say evil, you would say alienation built into everything. That even the most noble of our creations are filled with some sort of tragic flaw, and that we could not say that anything was perfect or on the way to being perfect. And so that we saw this as a basic critique of Marx. We also said that according to the Lutheran position, Christian position of justification by grace through faith, grace alone, that was a statement that said that one could not take any particular social system or anything within this world and raise it up to the level of God, raise it to the absolute. We could not, this was idolatry, and that essentially Marx was involved in an idolatrous absolutizing of what is only to be relative and imperfect in this world. And of course we cited some very historical examples of Marxism where we thought contradicted any of its basically noble motivation.
It was a good summary this morning. In fact, it shed some additional light, I think, because it was made it in one statement. We moved in various and diverse directions this morning, and I think that was a very helpful summary. Let me open it for, first of all, questions of clarification. Are there things you'd like Paul to clarify a bit more? Is there something that struck you that...
Well, okay.
Yes.
Did you just say that the Marxists are struggling for utopia on Earth, or just see it as a means, the best means possible for social economic order?
Well, according to orthodox Marxist theory, they are working for what you could call a utopia in which all the contradictions of history are overcome. This is an age where there is no dissension between people or between classes or between nations. They don't even need anybody to rule because they live in total harmony. Now, there is a place in Marx where he talked about both stage one, that is the primitive communism, original communism, and stage three, the classless society, where he calls them regulative. You know, that maybe you should not take them in their substance, but you should see them as principles which regulate how we act now. But the basic thrust in there is that this is happening through the laws of determinism. And of course, because this is an actual reality which is coming towards us down the road, it has this great attraction among of people who have nothing.
But how many communists actually believe that they'll ever attain true communism? I mean, they don't, I mean, like the leaders of the Soviet Union, do you feel that they really believe that this is someday going to happen, or are they more pragmatic than that?
Well, of course, a lot of has happened since many Marxists today believe that Orthodox Marxism is sort of an old religion, even. And certainly in communist China, even Mao has stated that he thinks that the law of contradiction is keeping on working. There will be a dialectical movement even beyond the classless society, that there will always be room for betterment. But I have never heard anybody in Eastern Europe say that. Of course, I've been in East Germany for 6 years, and that's probably the most humorless type of Marxism. You'd think even Marxism could be more fun than that. But that's, you know, and they're very orthodox, and they hold to that with a firm belief that this is coming according to the laws of history.
He also said, Paul, that there is no utopian notion in Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
How does that feel to the group?
Well, according to the Lutheran theology, that's fairly accurate. Taking sin, the radical nature of sin, so seriously. But you mentioned that Christianity doesn't see that. Well, it seems to me that Mennonite groups and some of these outfits, Sojourners Magazine, and their type of Christian discipleship, the way they take their Christianity so seriously, they, in all the writings I've read, seem to believe that through their witness, their leadership, through faithful service to Jesus Christ, utopia will arrive before he does.
And Luther also says, doesn't he, in the explanation of the Lord's Prayer, your kingdom comes with or without us, so Lord, we pray that it will come also.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think we have to be clear that God brings in his kingdom. We do not bring in the kingdom.
All right.
He brings in the kingdom, but that's another thing to jump from that to saying that he brings it in within this historical order, and that this is finally a time of perfection. I mean, you don't want to limit God's power. We're not talking about another world. We're talking about a new heaven and a new earth. But where the lion will lie down with the lamb, contradictions will be overcome. But then something more cataclysmic has to change. I see that the whole idea of the second coming of Jesus Christ is something that preserves or something that safeguards an excessive sense of optimism as or over exaggeration of our abilities, an exaggeration of our abilities. I think one of the great evils has been to assume that out of our Enlightenment tradition that we somehow get better and better all the time. And it came out of the 18th century with all this optimistic view of history that Reinhold Niebuhr came out against so strongly, that along with our intellectual and technological progress, our moral progress took a parallel course, and that we were not going this way or this way dialectically, but that we were going really up. A lot of people still believe this today, but I think it is a myth that flies in the face of reality, that flies in the face of the Christian faith.
Let's stop right there and see if there's any response to what's just been said. This begins to address, I think, your question a little earlier, doesn't that? History and differences in the histories, or no? Let's hold that then for a minute. Any response to what?
Now, let me just add, there have been, in recent times, you know, after the time of Reinhold Niebuhr, and all those people who were caught up in the horrors of the 20th century, in the age of the greatest intellect, supposedly, here we have Auschwitz, here we have the Western Front, here we have Hiroshima and Nagasaki, here we have Vietnam, My Lai. You know, how could anybody hold this view in the 20th century, in the face of the Holocaust? How could anybody hold it? I don't know how anybody could hold this optimistic view. But there has come up since that time, and theologically it's borne by people like Pannenberg and Moltmann, in this country Karl Bratton, people who have talked again about utopia. But their visions of utopia are a little bit more modest, and are humbled by a good Lutheran sense of sin, which is sort of St. Paul's understanding. The good that I want to do, that I don't do. And the evil I don't want to do, I end up doing. The whole ambiguity of our human life is caught up in that phrase, and I would say that that is a constant that underlies all of our cultural creativity. We'll continue to do so.
Comments, questions? New issues?
Well, it seems that that's where the line is drawn. In our view of what humankind is like. In a balance, more good than bad, or more bad than good. And with that understanding, then you start your economic system. Capitalism is kind of based on the idea that, well, it checks and balances, and out of that checks and balance system, nobody will get out of line, hopefully. Whereas Marxists, at least as somewhat as we've seen it practiced, there is the checks and balances, but you're trusting the goodwill of the people in many ways to share with
each other. Maybe it's the opposite. You know, Marx said at one point that if you leave people alone, they become capitalists. Because capitalism is based on your egocentric motive to accumulate wealth for yourself. You have to sort of help people to become socialist, because that means that, I mean, it's probably, as Jan Hansen would say if he were here, he would say that there's more individual freedom under capitalism, but more collective freedom under socialism. Because you have to put some restraint upon it. And I think the whole idea of socialism is to put control so that people do not, someone does not earn a salary way out of line. And so that lower salaries can be brought up and the higher salaries brought down. That everybody can have the same medical care. That everybody can have the same right to an education, that everybody can have the same opportunity to involve themselves in culture and the arts. If we are to sort of equalize opportunity, we have to impose restraints. I remember when, during these years in East Germany, I used to be interviewed all the time, you know. It sort of made you feel good that people were paying that much attention to you. but most often it was a great nuisance and harassment. But in one of these interviews, I was on the train actually just passing through from Berlin to Copenhagen, and of course, member of the Staatssicherheitsdienst, the state security police, motioned to me as I was sitting in the compartment, and he said, Herr Pastor, oui, ich möchte Sie sprechen, you know? And I knew right away that I was being summoned for another one of these interviews, and sometimes they lasted 7 and 8 hours. But the interesting thing, he said, well, he says, we're not going to talk about where you were yesterday and all this. I want to talk about the things that divide us. And he says, well, this is one item out of the conversation. He said, I may have mentioned this once before. He said, in your country, you understand freedom in a very strange way. He said, look at freedom for you in New York City. It means everybody can carry a gun. Everybody can do what they want. Everybody can drive a car. And he recited how many murders, how many rapes, how many thefts occurred in New York City. Within the space of an hour. And he had all the statistics there, and he said, why do you believe something so ridiculous as that? He says, freedom is really the right of the community to live. He says, it's like when a fire breaks out in a theater. He says, in your system, everybody just runs for the exit, and people get trampled and killed, and people do not escape. He says, in our system, he says, we must give up some individual rights. We must give them up like to a man, to a person on the stage during the fire, who was going to say then, okay, this group, this exit, this group, order, and so forth. In other words, he's going to impose a few restrictions. And he says, our motto in the German Democratic Republic is von ich zu wir, from I to we. In other words, the big thing for us is not just the right of individual people, but the right of the community. So he says, look around. He says, here there's no poverty. Here there's good food for everybody, good clothing for everybody, educational opportunities, the arts and culture for everybody. I had a few things to say after he was through about how much freedom the community actually has. But I think that's a basic difference. And this is why we oppose, even in this country, why we wouldn't allow the socialist experiment to take place in Chile. Now all the documentation is available, and we see that the basic cause of the failure of the Allende government, and it's not as simple as this, I grant, was the involvement of the CIA to sabotage. It's just simply that. It's the same way in Angola. Why did we have to lose Angola? Why did we have to alienate all of Africa? Why did we have to undertake this very unpopular war? Well, it's because it was the Kissinger policy not to be concerned about the individual people in Angola. They were all killed, or many of them were killed. But we must stop Marxism in Africa. And according to that overarching principle, we shipped in all the weapons to Kinshasa and supported the UNITA forces. And it's not just the fact that we lost the war right after the Vietnam War was over. It's the fact that we took the wrong position to start with.
Let's talk about that a little bit. I think that was one of the issues that came up this morning. One of your critiques has been that as a nation we have been unduly and very simplistically, my words, not yours, hostile to communism. Therefore, we have not understood it. Therefore, we have made a series of historical moves that have not done much to aid understanding or people generally. Would that be a somewhat fair way of stating it? What are the possibilities? And this is one of the questions that surfaced this morning. What are some of the possibilities for correcting that situation? What do you see? How can we breathe some better understanding? Yes?
I think we need to understand that not everybody under the communist system is automatically hankering to do it our way. I didn't spend much time in the Soviet Union and spent half a dozen years. But one thing I realized, I think, is that people in the Soviet Union have suffered together like we never have. they feel that they have a better life than they did before. And they see promise. And they are eating. And when you see the palaces, like the Winter Palace or something like that of the Tsars, when you see how the very rich live, when you see the riches that the church has, and the beaded and the jeweled robes of the priests and so on and so forth, you begin to see why there was a revolution. When there were some people living so well and so many people not eating, something had to happen. And we look at the Soviet Union and we say, well, we know they all want to get rid of their government. How can they stand it and so on and so forth? But for the people there, for the masses of the people, it's better than they had it. And the great art museums, which were first private property almost, the masses, the ordinary dumb-looking peasants, are walking through gaping at the great art in the Hermitage, for example. At the ballet, at the opera, they're standing in line, but they're getting in. The ordinary people now get to share what only the wealthy had. And I think we need to understand that. I mean, a lot of people think, well, they've got to be unhappy under communism. But a lot of them are better off as they see it than they were before. That's one thing I think I've learned.
So there is this need then to be better informed on our part, and we're asking how that might be done. I saw another hand way in the back simultaneously. Paul, I saw you. What was there, another one way in the back? Then Paul.
We can readily understand the need for the Russian Revolution. But I would be interested in how Paul's German inquisitor or questioner explained the need for the Berlin Wall.
Well, as I say, I had a few things to say too. And this was one. I said, look at freedom of your community, look at this wall. I described to him, if he hadn't seen it, because he probably hadn't gotten that close, or maybe he had, the Church of the Reconciliation. Maybe some of you know of it. So an American pastor, Ralph Zorn, has been pastor of that church. It's right in the Bernauerstrasse in North Berlin, right on the wall. The wall itself, and the wall is a very ugly thing, built the night of August 13th, 1961, under Walter Ulbricht, who was really a Stalin man in East Germany. It's an ugly wall. It goes right straight through this church. The wall of the church is part of the wall. The statue of Jesus Christ has a couple of vocal guards on top looking down with searchlights. It's got tank traps and wires and dogs running to awaken the guards. It's got towers and anti-tank devices. And it's called the Versöhnungskirche, the Church of the Reconciliation. And I said this to this man in this place. And then he went on the typical East German trip, which is this. You know, they have brochures about the wall. They call it the Wall of Peace. You can buy a booklet there that says the Wall of Peace. They take bus tours to show their wall. You know, it blows their mind. They say this, and you have to think about their argument. They say, well, in order to build the socialist economy, picking up the point, we have to have things contained. We can have to have two economies side by side. Now what happened in 60 is that the United States introduced a new currency system into Berlin so that people in the East could work in the West and do the same amount of work and receive three times their wage. Instead of 50 pfennig, you got 1 mark 50. And they did the same amount of work. And the introduction of this is only one element, this currency reform meant that certainly the intelligentsia and the crafts would move over to West Berlin, this sort of island in the midst of East Germany, to do their work if they could do it, or move over to West Germany, which had the same economy as West Berlin. And so finally, everybody was being drained out of the country, and so they realized that if we're going to try and experiment in socialism, we can't have so much interference from outside. If we're going to try to equalize things among the people, especially the land, if we're going to have the land reform, what should we do? Now, I'm not explaining the wall. I'm saying this was his response. And it goes up to a point. But in the final analysis, I don't think he's got a, you know, an argument in the world. I mean, they've killed their own people. They've shot them down. People try to escape these days. It's very, very difficult. They work on the wall continuously, day and night, making great, bigger and better wall. And we've talked to some people who have had very close encounters with the wall. And it's the thing that divides families from families, churches from churches, nation from nation. Although I would say that the United States is not unhappy that the wall is there, at least the wall that divides Germany in half. You know, it's like the Frenchman Marceau said before he died, he says, I love Germany so much I want two of her. And there's great fear of reunification of Germany on the part of the British and the French and the Americans, and certainly the people who suffered the most in the war, the Russians. But it's no final answer to your question.
I see you starting from just an economic starting point, but the thing I don't hear, is the what appears to me the real difference is the Marxist, or at least the way Marxism has evolved, use of violence to solve the problem or to establish their position, as maybe opposed to other socialist experiments, which may be taking time to evolve, but would appear to have the same economic goals, Sweden or some of the other countries, for example. It seems to me that is the fear of a lot of people rather than the economic change.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you asked that, because this was my question I have down as a list of questions for which I'm not sure I have any answer. I think the one in Chile, that was a fairly nonviolent revolution. I think we made a great mistake in really undercutting this experiment. They took the land away, of course, and there were the German landowners in Chile who were sleeping with their pistols under their pillows because they just didn't want their holdings divided up among the poor. And so there were touches of violence here and there, but basically, it was a smooth revolution, and I think we made a big mistake. But over against that, you can bring in waves not only of Stalinist-type violence, which we know to be just something that is incomprehensible when you look at the evidence, and we see the violence of the Chinese Revolution also. More recently, we see the violence in Ethiopia, especially among our Mekane Yesu Church, because a lot of them have different tribal affiliations. You know, there would be days and days when the young people of the church would be rounded up and executed at night, and their bodies would be dumped on the various street corners of Addis Ababa. The parents would have to come and claim their body, paying for them by the number of bullet holes. You have to pay by the bullet hole in your child. It's so grotesque that it, and of course now, even those church leaders that took part in the revolution have now turned against the revolution. And some of them have been killed, as you've probably read in the Lutheran Standard this past week. Gudina Tumsa, the General Secretary of the Church, was arrested for the second time, taken to that one precinct in Addis Ababa that is known for its torture. And he was tortured along with his daughter, a very young daughter. And that is enough to convince anybody that any discussion has to deal with this question. But now, let me just throw in one other thing. Okay, look at our churches in Namibia. There, the Lutherans are in the majority of the whole population. That's a church suffering. The agony of their suffering is just unbearable. What did they lose? 15 members of a women's altar guild-like organization. Just cut down in the field by South African soldiers. how many people at the Oshagamba Lutheran High School have been tortured? Almost every single teacher. At the Angola Lutheran Hospital and Angolan border that I visited 4 weeks ago, the decimated looking head of this hospital, tell the story about his torture. Now this church, of course, says, we would like to look to the West. We want to be democratic and we want to have an open society. But we find that our only friends in the struggle are the Soviet Union, the Eastern Bloc countries. And this is why the deacon of the Ovambo Lutheran Church is in East Berlin negotiating for arms. They do not like violence, and their history of Lutheran piety is just against violence of all kinds. Eat the speaker.
Yeah, that whole notion of violence, I just get distracted. But
what is? I'd like to ask the question. What is the answer for these people?
I have something to add to that. In the same line, we were talking this morning about Orthodox communism, and you said that many of the countries now have a different kind of communism than Marx originally thought would happen. And in that light, China and Cuba, I think, are even more prominent, especially in the African continent and South American continent, than Russia. And we were talking a short time ago about what we could do differently. Is there something we can learn from Cuba and China about what they're doing in these third world countries? This is just what you were saying now. They're getting arms. That is, we should send out arms, maybe, maybe not. But what can we learn? Do you want to talk a little bit about Cuba and China's presence in the third world? And what that type of communism and what we possibly could learn from that?
Well, you remember that Andrew Young made this initial statement that got him into so much trouble, where he said that Cuba was a stabilizing influence on Africa. Of course, he regrets the moment that he said it. But at the same time, I think if you got him in a corner and asked him, he would hold to his statement. As the Latin American liberation theologian Jose Benigno says, he says, it's not the question of being involved in violence or no violence. He says we are all caught up in violence of one form or another. It is sometimes a system that breeds violence. It is the system of exploitation that breeds violence. It is maybe our support more directly of the supplying some arms. You know, we supply arms to most countries of the world. All they have to do is order it from a book and we'll send it to them. In the Angolan War, we just shipped all these arms, and we have great patches of Soviet arms that we send to carry out these wars in North Carolina and in Texas. Read the book In Search of Enemies by John Stockwell. It's just come out. It's been a bestseller. Or last year it came out. It's a story. This man was the leader of the Angola Task Force of the CIA. Very respected by Kissinger and the administration. Of course, he could not take it anymore, and so he quit. And against all regulations, he told his story. This is its story. His story is in this book, In Search of Enemies. And it reads sort of like fiction, but it happens to be true. Now, I don't want to digress from your point, but I think that what we're opposed to is the imposition of a type of order on society like they have in Cuba and in communist China. And that maybe the big change in our thinking has to be that, and maybe we're understanding it now in terms of gas crisis and having to line up for gas, and that even in our own society, we're going to have to come to the point where we think of freedom in other terms. Where we think of equity in other terms, where we think of the sharing of resources in other terms. It goes against the stark individualism upon which this country was founded. At least I'm saying that I think that we have to look closely at the Chinese experiment and the Cuban experiment, and maybe the Cuban experiment would be better. And I think it would be if we were willing to lift the sanctions against Cuba. We've been very hard on Cuba. I think maybe it's time that we lifted the sanctions. I would make no brief for Marxism in any circle whatsoever. Although I would say that given the complexity and the fact that a world that's now at 4 billion is going to go up to 11 billion before it levels off, according to the World Bank, that we are at a major turning point in history, and that one of the directions that we have to take is the direction of, I shouldn't even say the word socialism, it'll get me into trouble, maybe, but a more of a common sharing through the management of the economy. What should they do in East Germany when the family farm handed down from grandfather to son is suddenly made state or public or common property? Should they man the barricades? Or do the Christians say, it's God's world anyway? And maybe even grandfathers and fathers and sons' land should now be looked upon, even under so-called public control, as still God's oikomene. And maybe even through this new economic system, it can bring forth the fruits of the earth that can be shared more equally among the family of the country. Is there anything intrinsic in our belief that the private ownership of property is the only virtue? And I think that both Cuba and China are putting this question to us. I know it flies in the face of all of our laissez-faire capitalism that we've grown up with in this country. But I'm not sure if we can still afford the luxury of that. I'm no economist.
I just have a feeling eventually someday we're going to have to face it when we're forced to do it, or when we choose to do it with some intelligence, that we meet these problems head on. Are there any... I'm so confused. It seems like the United States gets involved in some places in Africa and makes a total mess of things. There are other places that seem if they could, they would come to us, but they can't, so they turn to what we say is bad. It seems like, are there some basic things that we need to do to make decisions that are more consistent with what we say we are, or as we develop what we think we must be, or becoming? Can we work together the way we, with other types of social economic systems? Well,
isn't our problem we're too frightened of communism, that we're not thinking straight?
I think that's a big thing. Even within the church, there's some people hand out this sort of called underground evangelism. I don't know if it comes to your church, but it's one of these big frightening type views that keeps us from... That's the most ridiculous image of the life of the church in Eastern Europe I've ever seen. It keeps up the kind of pride if you put yourself in their position. They're so frightened of us. They are just so frightened of us, and the walls are so great from that side too. They see us with capital and power as the great oppressive force. And so the image is on both sides, and I think before going to what you're saying, that has to be broken. How can it be broken? How can it be broken in a congregation? I think that's where it's not. You know, we've got this, by the way, this Helsinki Agreement now. This has allowed us to break through, for one thing, to the Soviet Lutherans. Now Ambassador Goldberg looks to the churches and says, who represented the United States at the Helsinki and then the follow-up conferences, he says, now it is up to the churches and to organizations in the United States to work out the implications of the Helsinki Agreement. Now you should travel to Estonia, Latvia, Lithuania. Have we been refused yet? I don't think so. Now we're traveling to Siberia. These congregations, now pastors are being trained for the first time. Bibles are being brought into the country very freely, in big trucks. Theological literature. There are all sorts of things I think that we can do to break down the walls of misunderstanding. Have we ever talked to a Marxist? You know what we say, huh? And he's going to stab us in the back. I think those opportunities are certainly available. And that we should, even in a congregation, should say, okay, we're going to save money and send two people. Maybe not to China, because there's still junket type things going on, but we're going to send somebody to see Archbishop, the Lutheran Archbishop Matulis in Riga, Latvia. Find out what those people are really thinking. And come back and help us to understand. Instead of taking these Luther tours of East Germany, which are usually not that, well, it's nice to see the places and all, but if we want to really know what these people are thinking there, there are about 9 million Lutherans in East Germany still. That's a lot of Lutherans. The life of the church is vital and vibrant. They publish Bibles, a million Bibles, in churches that are open, youth groups that are very vital. The life of the churches in the East is something we should be familiar with. But I would hazard a guess that if you took a poll about life in East Germany, people would have all phantoms come off.
I think there's been a theme running through and through the discussion tonight, that there's kind of an intense and even intentional ignorance of one another that we keep perpetrating, pursuing. I mean, we have not broken down those kinds of barriers. We're coming to the close. We always try to close within 1 hour. Officially, and then we have spillover afterwards. But I saw one hand here. Do I see others that would like to have an opportunity before we come to a conclusion? 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, we have 4, and we'll take them in order. I think I saw your hand first.
I think probably one big problem facing us in this country, I mean, this sort of thing, is the press itself, our press. Using the way they use the term Marxism, because they label everything Marxism when it really isn't Marxism, because it may have been originally Marxism, but it can change so in the various countries, like you mentioned, Cuba and China and Yugoslavia and even Nicaragua now. The church leaders down there are leaders of the rebellion, and they succeeded. Can't we put away some of this to the impressions we get from our press?
Yeah. I think you're absolutely right on target. You know, there was this little article on the back page of the Seattle Times 2 days ago. It said, it was titled, 187 guerrillas killed in Zambia by the Rhodesian Air Force. And then if you read the article, it talked about Marxist guerrillas. I would venture to say that 100%, maybe that's an exaggeration, let's say 95%, I'll be very conservative, of those so-called Marxist guerrillas who were killed were members of the Christian Church. I would hazard to guess that they were Christian teenagers who were killed. The camps throughout Angola, the camps in Zambia, the camps in Botswana, Mozambique, are all run by the Lutheran Church and the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees. If you want, well, it's hard to get into the camps, but it's still possible to, if you wanted to see them. If you've been to the camps, you'll see 40,000 teenagers in the church. Now, these are Christian teenagers. They have their devotions every day. Their life is one of boredom and anxiety and fear that they're going to be attacked by napalm by Ian Smith's government. They still have that fear. And now that Abel Muzorewa attacked on Good Friday our Lutheran World Federation camps in Botswana, in Francistown, and our camps on the edge of Lusaka, makes me totally convinced of what I had feared before, namely that it is just a perpetuation of the attacks against those people who are only struggling for a little dignity a little independence of their country. That most hideous euphemism that we have perpetrated on these on these young people is to call them Marxist terrorists. The same thing we've done in southern Angola to the Namibians. I would say that 100% of the young people that were killed at Kasinga and called in the South Africa press and in the news releases that came out of Johannesburg, that they called it Marxist terrorist camp. I brought the news clippings with me if you want to look at them. This is the Marxist terrorists, actually 100% of those who were there, 4,098, it was a small camp, but those who were killed were members of the Ivamba Kavamba Lutheran Church, son of the bishop, daughter of the previous bishop, son of Reverend Mrs. Shapina, the son of Reverend and Mrs. Shikanga. You could go on and on about not only them being Lutherans who were killed, and Marxism. They say we don't have really any appeal to Marxism. Most people don't know what Marxism is. And when I was there in southern Angola about 4 weeks ago, I talked to people about Marxism. We stopped by this Lutheran youth choir, 60 voices singing hymns in the church. We weren't supposed to stop there. It wasn't on our itinerary, but we stopped there and they sang and we greeted them from Lutheran young people in this country. And when we left, instead of just waving to us, they all gave us the Black Power salute. You know? That if you do anything or make any critique of South Africa or Rhodesian government, you are a Marxist, ipso facto. And I think you're right on target. The poor
so
have no voice.
Real challenge of the press. The hand in the back. I'm going to put limits on your responses now, Paul. Out of concern for your voice at this point, because you've really been doing yeoman duty again today. But there was one question in the back. Peter, I guess.
Yeah. Just a comment. You know, I see two major groups, two major organized groups that are concerned about the oppression of peoples, especially in South Africa, Latin America as well, the communists and the Christians. And so they're sort of thrown together all the time in these situations because of their concern for the people that are suffering. The difficulty is that the organization behind the communists are willing to send guns and money for guns. And that raises a real problem. In spite of this conflict, in spite of the oppression, how can Christians, whoever are involved, aid these people with any kind of aid that they know is going to go towards killing, and regardless of who it's killing, you know. And so how can the Christians can never win out? I mean, they can never be the sole supporting group of the oppressed people, so that it seems like Marxists or communists or whatever always will have an upper hand in terms of the resulting government after an overthrow ultimately takes place. And the problem, but there can never be a reconciliation between the two either, you know, the way I see it, because although some of the goals are similar, you know, Christ talks about the rich man, he can't get in heaven unless he gives away his money, you know. He almost talks, I realize that Christianity doesn't preach that this utopia will ever be reached, but in a true Christian community, you have a classless society. But the problem is, it's voluntary there, you know, it's through the will of God, whatever. Whereas, and that can never be reconciled with forcing that on you in communism.
Did you want to add to that?
Yeah, I'd like to answer that question somewhat. In the words of Pastor Farai Gambiza of Rhodesia, who visited us this fall to speak at the church that we were serving at that time. And in the course of different conversations with him, and different conversations that he had with other members of our church, he said, if you want to do something for our country, do something like the communists are doing. They are sending our children, these war children, who have nothing to do in the camps. Some of them are fighting, yes, but some are too young to fight. They should be in school. But there are no schools for them, or else they're inadequate. What the Marxists or communists are doing are taking them to China and taking them to Russia and educating them. Unfortunately, a lot of the students that go there are very unhappy with the situation once they get there, because they have to sign, some of them have to sign a paper that says that they will go against Christianity. And they get very upset with that, and some of them fly immediately back to these camps because they will not sign a paper like that in order to get an education. However, what is their choice? They have no choice. Our country offers them nothing. With all our riches, with all our possibilities in the Christian churches, we offer them nothing. He said, if just some of these churches will take one student and bring him to your country and educate him and learn to know him and to talk to him and to experience him as a person, you have done something for my country. When the changeover in government takes place, there will be a great vacuum of leaders. There are those who say the country will fall apart without the whites. That possibly is true. However, if we educate these children now while the war is going on, there will be leaders to take the place of these whites who really should go because of the mentality that they have. They'll never really be able to change because of the mentality they've developed over all these years. So he's asking us to do what the communists are doing already. Take our children, educate them, send them back to us. He's not asking for sums of money to just be used, although they have basic needs. We could help with their basic needs, food, medicine. There's so many people who, I'm taking too much time. There's so many people who objected to the World Council of Churches, 85,000, a drop in the bucket that we gave to those camps for fear that they would buy guns. Sure, some of them maybe have gone to guns, some of the money, but the majority, and probably 100%, has gone for basic needs. That's something we could do. Stop struggling against it. Give money to help these people with their basic needs. When we're done with that, take them, bring them to us, to this country. Get to know them as people. We'll always have that bond with them. That's something we can do. He said, what can we do? Those are his words.
Thank you. Thank you. No.
Just saying, one of the basic concerns here was individual interaction. And what we can, what role can we play now as people? Two persons that we may meet, and in our case we'll meet, or as individuals within our society. And until the very closing few sentences you made, and what she had to say, I had heard no approach to that. I heard, highly theoretical discussions of government actions and so forth, which I see very remote in my position. And I'd like to, hear that line pursued.
We have heard in a variety of ways an intentional program of exchange, of bringing to education, a number of ways. We've identified, it seems to me, an intentional ignorance that has been perpetrated on both sides of the issue as a root cause for the tension and hostility that exists today and for the cruelty.
So what do we do?
Well, I think what we're hearing are some very precise kinds of responses now to that. One of which you're going to be involved in, as I understand, very soon. You have an exchange student or someone coming from a communist bloc country, if I'm not mistaken, that will be living in your home, and it's going to be a salutary way, and you're going to be providing an opportunity, it seems to me, to share that on a wider base, that experience, and help your community itself discover maybe a tie. You've got a marvelous opportunity ahead of you to approach this. There was one other hand, was there? If not, I'm going to give Paul yes.
Yeah, I'm sitting here tonight absolutely amazed that I've never heard any of this before. I read magazines, I listen to news, I read newspapers. How come I've never heard this before? I don't understand. I can't believe it. I'm astounded that all these things are happening in the world.
Okay. I think you speak for many of us, number one. But I think, too, we must recognize that in our resource person, we have a very unique privilege right now. Paul functions on the world scene like few people do. So, we're in kind of a unique situation right now. And that's one, we don't get into this situation very often. Secondly, I think we've heard some suggestions that the press kind of works over against our hearing. We talked earlier this evening at Paul's earlier session that in the parish, I'm a parish pastor, you don't hear this, and I can tell you one reason, and here it sits. Not well informed, not my consciousness has not been lifted to the point where it becomes a, you know, it's happening now, thank God. But I mean, there are many causes. The point is, we are hearing, how do we move from this point? I've got to bring this to a close, and I promised Paul a two-minute summary statement, and then we'll adjourn officially.
Well, I don't know really what to say after that, but I mean, I think the whole business of communication is so important, because attitude is the bottom line. Before we can think about things, we have to try to get our own attitude right, and that's based on good information. I mean, maybe it's a circular thing. The poor have no voice. Now, we try in our office, we try to be a mediation, one of the points of mediation. We send out the information on Namibia and Southern Africa. In the back of the room, you see some of that. We send a packet of things to every congregation. We update it. Every second month, we update it. We send out cassettes now. Like you mentioned, the grant to the Patriotic Front of $85,000. Every congregation in this country, a Lutheran congregation, has gotten one of these cassettes that talks about this grant to the Rhodesian Army. Now you have to play that. It's just started, and maybe the pastor hasn't even got it himself. It's very expensive. It's about $30,000 each time you send out a tape. But we hope it helps a congregation to be better informed. Now that's only part of the thing. Otherwise, we've tried, of course, to bring some of the teenagers from Zimbabwe or Rhodesia to the United States. But as you rightly point out, it's just a drop in the bucket. Maybe we have to do more. Actually, our office deals with refugees within Africa, trying to resettle people within Africa. And as you know, there are 2.5 million refugees in Africa right now. That's a lot of refugees, and it's a terrible, terribly big job. But maybe we should bring these people over to the country. I'm listening to what you're saying, Julie.
Can I say just one thing? There's only one Paul Weed, and he can't be everywhere. He can't be talking to all of us, and he can't be talking to our other sister and brother congregations elsewhere. What we need is human beings willing to talk to human beings. And it's good to have communications from offices, but we know what happens to some of those. They sit on desks, they get lost, and so on. I mean, I wouldn't negate that or get rid of it. But what we need is human beings talking to human beings, one to one to one to one to one, until all of us have heard. And it starts here. And it starts here, and it moves on to us. If anyone is interested in a Rhodesian student, I can give you a name next week from Bishop Sherry. I challenge some of you to do that or take it to a place where you can do it. That's all I have to say.
Thank you. Paul, any concluding statement?
No, I think that's why it's maybe a little more complex. I want to, you know, dampen that.
Right.
And I think there are all sorts of things that we're not doing that we could do. As I say, if someone wants to see poverty, maybe someone has to go to Calcutta. Send someone from your congregation to Calcutta to view the Lutheran programs. You could stay there a week and come back, and you'd be, a totally new person. Maybe someone should go to Bangladesh and see just what the Lutheran churches are doing in Bangladesh with women's work, for example. I think someone should go to Riga, Latvia, to go to East Germany, not just to see the Luther sites. I think someone should go to, and I think our seminarians should go to Mexico City and live in the barrios and the poblaciones of Santiago. And I think that personal contact is important. And so there might be more creative things that can come out of the congregation, which must be one of the most creative institutions in all of American society, than we have dealt with here. But I think that's where it's all right.
We thank you, Paul Weed.